Little music from years back, many years back, to bring us up to date. Creedence Clearwater there, if I'm not mistaken, with The Fortunate Son. Perfect song to get us going here. We actually have a focus on music for the whole 2 hours. To begin the show, we're talking about the music of the Vietnam War on the show. Larry Mueller here, by the way. Thanks for joining in. And two guests for you. Doug Bradley is a Madison-based Vietnam vet who has written extensively about his Vietnam and post-Vietnam experiences. He's, 30 years of experience as a communication professional in higher education, mostly at UW-Madison. Doug, good to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you. It's been a while.
It has.
Been a while for Craig Werner as well. Happy you could make it too, Craig. Thank you for joining in. Craig's a professor emeritus of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, member of the nominating committee of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame at one point. Are you still doing it?
No, I resigned, but yeah.
He's written liner notes for re-releases of classical soul albums, contributed to many radio and TV documentaries on topics ranging from the Harlem Renaissance to Motown. And together, one of the things they did together was to write the book, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, the soundtrack of the Vietnam War, which I think Rolling Stone, back in that day, in 2015, named it the best music book of the year. Good on you guys.
Yeah. Well, good for the vets. I think the thing, Larry, about that was the more we wrote drafts of that book, the more we got ourselves out of the way, because we wanted the men and women who took the time to tell us about their music-based memory and basically in the process talk about their Vietnam experience. It was a way to, I think, acknowledge that and their voices. That's what we felt good about.
Yeah. And this, you know, August, we're in August, the month of August. It marks some anniversaries related to Vietnam War. I think it was August 4th was the 61st anniversary of the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. Remember what that resolution was all about, Doug?
Yeah.
Craig, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it was the incident in South China Sea, two incidents, actually, the first of which happened, the second of which probably didn't, that led Lyndon Johnson to go to Congress and request authority to fight the Vietnam War. He was approved, and that opened the door for a long, messy war.
Messy war. And I think it was in August of 72, the last U.S. combat troops left Vietnam. What do you remember thinking at the time as that happened?
Well, Larry, you know, it's a really interesting thing because I had left Vietnam late 71. And so we were sending troops home rather than expanding. I think people probably forget at one point, we had 550,000 troops in Vietnam. That is a big army. And now we're dwindling. We're going home. And sort of the notion was, you don't want to be the last GI killed in Vietnam. If we're leaving, you know, keep me alive. And so, especially for the combat troops who were in harm's way. And I remember being back here saying, finally, you know, guys are not going to get, well, they still got killed. But, you know, this part of that war is over. Let's stop. But we didn't. And they didn't.
Yeah. Well, today we're talking about some of the music of that time, Craig. And when people think about music from the Vietnam War era, you might automatically think about the protest music. But today, we won't be listening only to those kind of popular protest tracks. What music resonated with soldiers then and veterans today?
Yeah, well, the thing was that the music that showed up on the soundtrack of Vietnam films has a disproportionate impact on what people think about as the music of Vietnam. And one of the things we discovered very quickly as we were interviewing people for our book, and we've talked to several hundred veterans by this point, was that they didn't particularly need to hear that the war was a mess, you know. Sometimes they did, but what really spoke to them when we started interviewing them and tallying the songs that came up most frequently were songs like Leaving on a Jet Plane by Reeder, Paul and Mary, or My Girl by The Temptations, or Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, songs about missing home, wanting to get home, not nearly as political as the soundtrack that's kind of gone down into the mythology of Vietnam.
Yeah, and Larry, the funny thing was that all those songs that were also there, I mean, we have stories in the book about guys who had really rugged, determined, straight-ahead, by-the-numbers sergeants who also played the guitar and would sit outside some night and play Masters of War by Bob Dylan. And it was like, yeah, it was all there. The great thing about the music was, whether you stayed or served, participated or protested, we had the same soundtrack. And we had different takeaways from what that song meant, especially if you're in Vietnam. But that this universality of the music, and guys understood that there were people that didn't agree with the policy. Maybe not necessarily what they were doing. That's were some of that, too. But, you know, all that music was there. War by Edwin Starr, you know, Universal Soldier, you know, all the Dylan by... but it was like... it wasn't antagonistic in the way that I think a lot of people portray it.
So how did you then compile? We've got a list of 10 or a dozen songs here, and Lee Rayburn has his magic fingers ready to play some of those for us. He's wiggling them right now as we speak here. How'd you compile that list that you got for us?
We started out. We actually met at a Christmas party at the Vet Center in Madison, and Doug's son and daughter had both taken classes from whom we got talking about music. And all of a sudden, all of the guys at the party gathered around and started sharing their stories about the music. And so we sat down, went out to the terrace, had a beer, talked about saying, hey, maybe there's a book to be written here. And we started out by each of us listed our Vietnam Veterans Top 20. We thought we were going to do that to start it up with. And then once we started talking to people, it became clear that it was way more than 20. It was 200, there were probably 1,000 songs we mentioned in the book. But some of them came up again and again and again. Nancy Sinatra's These Boots Are Made for Walking, which I never would have thought of.
Came up a lot. We'll be hearing that a little later on. Cool. One of the songs, I don't know why it surprised me, but I Left My Heart in San Francisco by Tony Bennett. Well, let's listen to a bit of it, Lee.
I left my heart in San Francisco. High on a hill.
Oh, it calls to me.
Say it, Larry. You know, I'll be curious. I think your next guest will have something to say about music and memory and dementia, Alzheimer's, you know, that Tony Bennett had, yet he could still sing a song.
He could still sing a song. But why did this tune?
The early troops, remember, we're in Vietnam officially, 64 to 75. We'd been there pretty much right after the French, and even supplying the French in the 50s. The early advisors and some of the early troops that went to Vietnam sailed. You know, I left on a jet plane, flew to Vietnam. But the early and a lot of them would go out of San Francisco. And they were of that generation. A lot of these were... senior military. They'd been in Korea. They were a little older. And so Tony Bennett, World War II vet, you know, great voice. But that was sort of their music, their sound. And I think leaving San Francisco, a lot of them left their hearts in San Francisco. It was very literal. And so that song captured for a lot of them that whole notion of going someplace else, leaving, but also keeping something behind as well.
Yeah. I can imagine a guy on the troop ship leaving San Francisco and having that song run through his
big
mind.
Big time.
Big, big, big time. Well, there's another song about a city, Detroit City by Bobby Bear. And let's listen to that one for a bit.
Last night I went to to sleep in Detroit City. And I dreamed about those cotton fields and home. I dreamed about my mother, dear old papa, sister and brother. I dreamed about that girl who's been waiting for so long. I wanna go home.
There we go. What's amazing to me is I can remember all of those words. I wanted to burst into song as he was singing, but that would have ruined it for sure.
Hey, it's your show.
How did soldiers listen? You know, well, first, I can see where that would strike a chord.
Oh, sure. And one of the ways that the soldiers listened to music, of course, they listened to AFVN, they listened to the radio, they listened to tapes that were brought from new guys coming in or sent from home. But one of the things that they remember is, particularly those who were in the rear, remember the bands that played at the clubs, the enlisted men's clubs, and there was a repertoire that they pretty much had to do. Or else they were going to get booed off the stage. And there were a lot of Filipino bands. There were a lot of bands that were kind of like garage bands back in the States. I played with a garage band at the time in Colorado Springs. We played for a lot of soldiers. And there were songs that they wanted to hear. And genre didn't matter much. That, you know, that's a country song. Didn't show up on the rock and roll hit parade. But in Vietnam, that mix all came together, and the songs would get the vets singing. We saw that at a lot of the public events we did around the book where we played the music. People would just chime in and start singing. We did an event up at Lambeau Field. The Packers, we were in their team room, packed crowd. Our tape player went out. Didn't matter. The people could sing the songs just fine on their own.
Well, and Larry, as you were doing, as you were starting to sing yourself, that line, "I want to go home." So that's just, you know, we had assigned tours in Vietnam. We didn't go over as units. We didn't come home as units. We went separately, most of us. And I knew the day I got to Vietnam, November 12th, 1970, if I was lucky enough, you know, to make it through the year, November 11th, 1971, I was going to leave. 365 days. Marines had 13 months. You could extend. But so that notion of I want to go home. Yeah, I know when I'm going to go home, if I'm going to get there. The other thing that Craig alluded to with the cover bands was we had lucky guys like me in the rear. We had jukeboxes at some of the EM clubs. And occasionally, they would be the source of a little friction, because if somebody plays Bobby Bear 10 times in a row, he's going to get a beer bottle tossed at him.
Yeah. The black soldiers may not love that.
Oh man. Well, it's really fun. I was flashing on a few things. I was remembering when you were talking about limits. A friend of mine, rest his soul now, Ron Korfmacher, went over as he was a minister. Mm. And so he went over, and he was out in the field with, and he talked, and he wrote a book about his experience. But one thing that he mentioned was when you got to be a single-digit midget, which was under 10 days, and he had some good stories, and then one or two bad stories about that.
No. Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, guys had count. One guy told me one time when I was there that he had just broken 300 days, and I thought if I was counting down, I would go crazy. I mean, that's the thing; it would go drive you nuts. So I didn't have what they called a short timer calendar. I just wouldn't do it. I knew, just hoped and prayed that I was going to get there, but. You know, it's like I did not want to delineate this day by day by day, because like you said, sometimes you didn't get there.
Yeah.
That's a sad thing.
Yeah. I had another friend who, and I was thinking that, if I'm not mistaken, I think about of the people who went over, men and women who went over, about 20% of them did the fighting.
Yeah.
Larry, it's even crazier than that. Of the almost 3 million that served in that arena, over those 11 years, maybe 500,000 were combat troops. That's extending it. But that's all we, you know, that's war. That's what we see in the movies. That's what we know about. There were more of us in the rear, like me. Somebody had to write their stories. Somebody had to play their music. Mm-hmm. Somebody had to fly their helicopter. Somebody had to build their bridges. Somebody had to give more. So the ratio by the time I was, it's usually like 1 to 6, you know, 6 support. By the time I was in Vietnam, it was 1 to 8 or 9. Most of us were in the support. Now, it's not to say that, I mean, combat's the toughest and the roughest, and we know that's fighting and dying. And so, you know, that occurs. But the rest of us, you know, they had silence in the field. They got music when they got back to us. They gave us music. It was a wonderful thing.
I remember one really good friend of mine, Dean Helgeland, who went over, and he said, we got there, and they lined us up and said, and the sergeant or whoever it was said, "Who can type?" And there was a whole line, and he could type a little, so he took one step forward, and he was the only guy who stepped forward, and so he spent his whole time there typing reports and doing whatever. I think the rest of that bunch was out in the field fighting.
Yeah, one of the things that we also learned was that those numbers are what they are, but it doesn't mean that the people who were not combat guys were safe.
We talked
to one guy who was field baker out in the middle of one of the most dangerous areas where you could be, but because he was baking 20,000 loaves of bread a week or whatever it was, he didn't count as a combat guy, but he was getting shelled every night, same way as the rest of the guys there.
Well, they called me a combat correspondent. You know, I mean, sure, I had the air-conditioned jungle and I was back with the brass because they wanted air conditioning. But when I went out in the field and did a story, I'm a U.S. soldier. I'm the enemy. I mean, they could take a shot at me as well as anybody else.
We've got another song, and you know what? We should probably take a break. Have we taken a break yet? I don't think we have. Doug Bradley and Craig Warner are our guests today. We're talking about music of the Vietnam era. And you can join in. I've had a bunch of emails with some song suggestions or remembrances. You can join in, too. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you. All my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye. But the dawn is breaking.
Oh, Mary. What a voice. Peter, Paul, and Mary there on Leaving on a Jet Plane. How did the soldiers connect with that particular song?
Well, the connection, it's interesting, Larry, because, I mean, obviously, we left on a jet plane. I'm leaving on a jet plane. So for me, that song becomes me. And there's a line in there, you know, I hate to go. I don't know if I'm going to get back. So it's obvious that just fits. The wonderful moment that we had and what resonated for us was in 2010, the Green Bay Packers, the Oneida Tribe, the Veterans Museum, and Public Broadcasting had a LZ Lambo event. LZ stands for Landing Zone. It was a welcome home event for Vietnam vets. This is 2010. We've been home for a while. But, hey, better late than never. And when we were making the presentation, as Craig said, the sound system would sort of peter out. And when we played that song, the audience just sang the rest of the lyrics. And we looked at the wives holding the hands of their husband with tears streaming. And we realized that was a hard year for them, too. So the person taking the leaving and the person saying goodbye both had pain and worry for that whole time. So that song... And I think it surprised us that it came up so much. But when you think about it, the fact that we left on jet planes, we said goodbye, but also the people that waited for us to come back, that song was this sort of elasticity and connection that we needed to have. And it was very prominent in a lot of the conversations we had with vets.
And Lee played just before that, played These Boots Are Made for Walking by Nancy Sinatra. This assertive female voice here.
Yeah. It's a fascinating story. It's another one that I hadn't really thought of as a Vietnam song, but it comes up a couple of different ways. First of all, Nancy Sinatra was a major supporter of Vietnam vets. She played at reunions. She volunteered for them. She was beloved. She was pretty. And a lot of guys had pinups of Nancy Sinatra with the boots from the cover of that record.
Yeah.
But it also pointed to one of the things that we discovered, which is frequently songs had very different meanings in Vietnam and for the vets than they did on the home front. And "These Boots Are Made for Walking" was definitely one of those, because on one level, boots meant something very real to the guys out there in the field, walking with them endless miles. And there's also a line in there where she says, "You're lying where you ought to be truthin'." Right. And there was that sense that the truth was not being told about Vietnam. So she resonated on many, many levels.
Well, and I think to follow up just on what Craig said, and I think the thing for Nancy Sinatra was she went to Vietnam and she was a rock and roll star.
Yeah.
And when they came to folks like her came to Vietnam, she went to the hospitals and she saw guys that were her age whose bodies were broken and, you know, and were shattered from the war. And that was a real epiphany for her. I think it changed her trajectory of her career, but I also think it impacted her a lot emotionally. And as Craig said, she's become a huge supporter and the vets love her.
Yeah.
And going to Vietnam had a big impact on the other relatively small number of people who did. James Brown went in a very famous tour of it. Johnny Cash went, and Johnny Cash said that he considered himself a hawk when he went to Vietnam, pro-war guy. And he said, talking to the soldiers and coming back, he declared himself a dove with claws and wrote quite a bit about Vietnam, sang about it.
Well, one of the soldiers, there was a special forces medic, I believe Barry Sadler, who had a different kind of, a different song. You got that up, Lee? Let's play that one for a minute.
Trained to live off nature's land, trained in combat hand to hand, men who fight by night and day, courage take from the green beret, silver wings upon their chest, these are men, America's best.
So, Ballad of the Green Berets.
Well, when you think of all the tremendous music there was in 1966, we're dating ourselves, I know here, Larry, but we were all there. The best of the British Invasion, the Beatles, the Stones, they were always at the top of the charts. Best of Motown, the Temptations, the Supremes, Smoking the Miracles, Four Tops, and the best of country, Cash and Haggard, Jennings. That was the number one song of 1966. The Ballad of the Green Berets, and you can't dance to it. I mean, come on. but the thing was, Sadler tapped into something. A, he'd been there, so he knew as a Special Forces troop and his advisor what was going on. He stepped on a punji stick. He was recovering from some infections. He was back at Fort Bragg when it was being dedicated to JFK, who had been assassinated in 63, and sort of tapped into this notion of service and sacrifice. You can sort of march to that. It's elite, if you're a Green Beret. But now's the time that we sons of World War II vets, my dad was a World War II vet, so was Craig's, probably yours too, that they stopped fascism, we need to stop communism. So he was tapping into something in the American ethos that was, popular, and it resonated.
One of the things that we found where people were talking about that song is that several of the guys we talked to talked about how that song was part of what sold them on Vietnam, made them want to go do their duty in the same way that our World War II dads had, but that several of them talked about how bitter they were about it after they had been there.
Yeah.
They said the irony was just overwhelming. Yes.
We have several other songs. Mike in Appleton said his song is Where Have All the Flowers Gone by the Kingston Trio. Did that ever come up? Or
it comes up a lot, you know, at whoever's version. And, I mean, it's a Pete Seeger song, and it's just, it says it, what it is, and that is, you know, gone to graveyards, everyone. It's just the way that song progresses. And that was on a lot of guys' minds. I mean, we have a great anecdote that begins the book at the Siege of Khe Sanh, which is probably the worst battle of that war. 55 days of relentless attack. They were surrounded by an NVA army. Because of the fog, they couldn't get the air support in there they needed. So they were just hammered day after day. And there were guys on the top of, sandbags. A guy playing a guitar singing, Where Have All the Flowers Gone? This was captured on CBS News, you know, and we used to do reporting and coverage in depth. Yeah. And so just that song has got so much power and meaning to it, but also that it was a way for some community and some comfort for these guys under siege. It speaks volumes about music.
Yeah. Bruce in Elk Mound has something. Let's go there. Bruce, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that the country music was a little bit more popular, I think, than you guys are making out. But I know one of the songs was Stand By Your Man by Tammy Wynette.
Oh, yeah.
It was a real tearjerker. And they also played a lot of the Beatles. Sure. And I think towards the end, before I left, was Hey Jude, and it was on there about hourly.
Yeah.
And the other thing of interest is they didn't play a lot of hard rock and roll at all. Like,
Nope.
Yeah,
the sites on the internet, because I think the guys out in the field were already crazy.
Bruce, thanks for calling. Comments? Yeah. Go ahead, Craig.
On the country, I'm absolutely with you on that. This is one of the things that Doug grew up in Philly. I grew up in Colorado Springs. I grew up with country, and I grew up playing it, and mm-hmm. I know it. And
there were
a ton of great country songs that were on the Vietnam Vet. You had a heavy rotation there. And on the hard rock, that was one of the places where, although censorship wasn't quite what it's made out to be, it never made the FEN, heavy rotation. But we talked to DJs who were on small stations out in the field who played a ton of it. And then on the underground radio station, that was all they played.
Yep, exactly. And it was, you know, we were the rock and roll generation. So, I mean, like I said before, the lucky thing for us, especially guys like me in the rear, is we had Creature Comforts and we had AFEN 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, transmitters from the Delta DMZ, bands coming to Vietnam, EM clubs, tapes, cassettes. So they gave us access to music. And so we found that stuff. People would, like Craig said, they were sending, you know, there was a Traffic album, John Barleycorn Must Die. Cream albums. They were right there in the PX. I could just buy them. So we had all that music, but it wasn't what was prevalent either on the AFEN playlist or, you know, for a lot of guys who were, you know, out in the field.
So the guys out in the field, could they, you know, have their transistor radio, or did they have a cassette recorder that they might have taken with them?
It's a mixed bag. Out there. One of the things that came through very, very clearly, our good friend Tom Helgeson, when I asked him about what his experience was, and he was out in the field with a really tough tour, he just said, well, the music was there in his head, but he said that silence was worth $1 million a minute when you were out there. So we actually talked to one guy who talked about the way that having the music in his head interfered with him. He got Leslie Gore's song, Judy's Turn to Cry, his girlfriend's favorite song, stuck in his head when he was out doing a sniper's gig. And he said that he realized it was distracting him, and that was dangerous. Sometimes units did carry records with them, portable record player, spread it around. We have good stories about when they had the opportunity put on music and dancing in their combat boots.
We hear from helicopter pilots who are taking the troops out and up and down and out. that they could play it on the band on their radio. Yeah, there was a band on the radio that was reserved for communications, you know, critical communications. And sometimes guys would go on there and just play music.
Yeah.
Barbara in Cross Plains, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. This is kind of a hard thing to talk about. I am the spouse of a vet, Vietnam vet, who served his career in the military. And he was in Air Force ROTC here on campus 4 years. And as those 4 years got closer to graduation, we knew where he was going. Mm. The day he graduated, he was commissioned. 9 months later, he was on the ground in Vietnam. Mm. And yeah. We were married. We've been a couple of years. He talks about some of it, but in reference, if just to make it short, first I got a letter almost every day. There was a number at the top of every page, how many days were left. Mm. Yeah. And he said when he got on that plane to come home, the troops, they burst out in singing,
I want to go home.
Oh, you got to get out of this place. Yeah. Yeah.
And the one that broke my heart when he was gone was Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around That Old Oak Tree.
Tony Orlando and Dawn. Is your husband still with us or no?
Yes. Oh, he served 21 years, and he's an honorable retiree.
Glad he made it home. Tell him welcome home. And that's kind of the stories the way they are. I mean, you know, service, sacrifice, a lot of that generation. And again, like I said, you know, how we were raised as the sons of World War II vets. Your husband took that seriously.
Yeah. Barbara, thank you so much for calling. Aretha Franklin had a song that was quite popular with the guys, apparently, Chain of Fools. Let's listen to a little of that. So, how did I think I can see why it might have been popular? But
well, you know, and it's amazing, Larry, because this is again getting to what Craig talks about. It, you know, different meanings for different folks and different experiences and different circumstances and different times. I hear that song. I'm a junior in college, a small college in West Virginia, with my student deferment, which I eventually lost. And you talked about, you know, Nancy Sinatra being a strong woman. Aretha's as strong as they come.
Yeah.
She's just had RESPECT, and now she's having this. She says, if you play me for a fool, I'm just another link in your chain. I'm done with this relationship. So that's a good takeaway for that song when it was out, that she was done with this guy. Well, as Craig found out, yeah, and we found out,
that you can hear that chain is going to break multiple ways. It was also a Black Power song, talking about, yeah, okay, we've been, yeah, told that the dream is going to come, but it ain't coming. So this chain is going to break. We're going to rock out. But in military terms, the chain referred to the chain of command, the sense that black soldiers got to a point, particularly after Dr. King's assassination, where they said, you can fight your own war. We're going to stay here. We're going to be in our soul hooches, and we're only going to do minimal cooperation. Now, that wasn't everybody by any means, but it was a real thing.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it was saying the chain of command is broken. So Aretha was speaking to that, too.
Keith and Kiwani, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Keith.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. So I was on a helicopter gunship down in the Delta, and we would... So I flew out of a bigger base camp at Vinh Long, and we would have bands from the Philippines or Japan or wherever come in and play music in our clubs, and they would sing American songs in English perfectly, but you couldn't communicate with them. You couldn't speak to them or understand them. We did have an Australian band come in one time, which was just something to be able to sit down and talk with the Australian band, which we mostly understood. The other thing, most of the It seemed like most of the concerts, the songs at the end of the night, the very last song was always, "We got to get out of this place" by the Animals.
Yep, yeah. I second that emotion, Keith. I'll just say welcome home. Glad you made it. I just ditto what you said. These Filipino, Korean, and Vietnamese bands could not speak a word of English, but they could play a set list, everything from Janis to Bobby Bear to Creedence and the Animals, but not speak a word of English. I mean, more power to them, because we needed the music. And, of course, I can't say enough about the resonance and significance of the Animal song, "We Got to Get Out of This Place."
Yeah, Keith, thank you very much for calling. Visiting today with Doug Bradley, Madison-based Vietnam vet, Craig Werner, our other guest, Professor Emeritus of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, talking with them about the music of the Vietnam War and kind of from their book that they were able to put together, "We Got to Get Out of This Place, the Soundtrack of the Vietnam War." I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
I'm coming home.
Purple Haze by Jimi Hendrix. That's sort of, does it reflect the chaos that was going on?
Oh, yeah. And different kinds of chaos. Again, this is one of those that I remember growing up as a hippie, and Purple Haze was a term for a particular kind of LSD. You could hang out on the hill, lean back, kiss the sky, just go blissful. But,
you know, also Hendrix, the thing about Hendrix was he was a soldier. He was maybe the worst soldier in the history of the Army. He got kicked out because all he did was play his guitar. But he was airborne. So "Kiss the Sky" is what they said when they jumped out of the airplane. And so that's got a different meaning for Hendrix. The other thing about Hendrix was, getting back to the earlier caller about, you know, acid rock and the heavy rock, that sound was there, and the thing about Hendrix's music is it sounded like Vietnam. If you listen to a song he's got called Machine Gun, or just what he did with the Star Spangled Banner at Woodstock, everything is in there, you know, just weaponry and helicopters and call to arms. So sonically, Hendrix, more than I think anybody else, was the sound of Vietnam. And then there's another Purple Haze.
Yeah. I mean, all kinds of stories. But one of the meanings of Purple Haze was that they had smoke grenades where they would call people into
landing zones.
And the purple was one of the colors of that. And so the purple smoke was a part of Hendrix. Yeah, a lot of meanings.
Lynn in Pewaukee emailed us about the movie Good Morning Vietnam with Robin Williams, who was really, I thought, did a great job in that movie. She's wondering if it was based on a real Vietnam DJ, and you've got a story on that, Doug. Adrian Cronauer.
Adrian Cronauer, who, to his credit, I think, was one of the first AFVN DJs that understood what the troops wanted to hear. They didn't want to hear Guy Lombardo and Ray Conniff, you know, and any kind of pablum. They wanted to hear what they were listening to at home when they had just gotten there. They're kids. You know, so they want to hear the Temptations. They want to hear James Brown. They want to hear Elvis and the Beatles. And he changed the format with his Dawn Buster show. The funny thing for us was, because we knew, you know, how important DJs were to the morale of the troops, we interviewed a lot for the book. And they were very forthcoming, talked about the censorship, talked about the ups and downs, et cetera. So we reached out to Cronauer because he's the dean. He's the guy, right? And at that point, the movie had been successful. He'd made a lot of money. He was working with Dick Cheney, as a matter of fact. And we got a note back from his agent saying he didn't want to be interviewed by two people two guys from the People's Republic of Madison. I was like, wait, this is a book about music and memory, and it's serving vets. But hey, if it was enough of his life in the public record, he's no longer with us, neither is Robin Williams. But that movie captured at least that. There's parts of that movie that are Hollywood that wouldn't have happened. But the music and what that meant to the soldiers and what the DJs were able to do to make those connections is a really vital story.
And to follow up on what Doug had said, one of the interesting things, as we did well over 100 public events built around the book, we had no cases where we had a political fight break out over Vietnam, which is pretty much unthinkable. You wouldn't get that at some point. But the music provided a way for people to process it and share it together. We were in Memphis, and we had a situation where a black vet from Memphis and a white vet from Memphis, which came from different worlds before they went there, realized at the event that they had been there together. It overcame a lot of differences. You know, that the music does something that our political memory seems incapable of.
Yeah. Jerry in Cross Plains emailed, as a Vietnam vet, I remember laughing a lot with the AFRS TV show Good Morning Vietnam. While not a song, it sure was well-liked by the troops, including me.
On laughter. Do you want to talk about it?
I feel like I'm fixing to die. It's just, you know, Larry, when you're in... You know, I feel like I'm fixing to die is on the soundtrack, the Country Joe and the Fish song. And it's like we were both astounded. I mean, we knew the song. We knew Joe's presentation at Woodstock, which is a little rougher, a little raw. So we wanted to get to the source of this. We went and interviewed him in San Francisco. And when we got off, he met us at the BART Center. And we got off the train. The first thing he said to us was, I'm a veteran first and a hippie second. Well, who knew Joe McDonald was a vet? Well, not a Vietnam vet, but he'd been in. He intended that song as gallows humor. And it gets to this point of when you're in this most critical situation, when you are about, you know, an inch away from losing it, laughter sometime can, you know, bring you back. And so gallows humor was very prominent in Vietnam. Laughter, I laughed a lot in Vietnam because what else was I going to do? I was going to go crazy. I was going to go nuts. I was going to scream. So yeah, when I think about music and what it did, but I also think about what laughter helped us do. Those were most important.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die by Country.
Come on, all of you big strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. Got himself in a terrible jam, way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books, pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7.
Yeah, Joe said that he still gets hate mail for that, people considered it disrespectful to the veterans, but he said never got that from the veterans.
We gung-ho guys who used that as cadence for their troops, you know, and made them march to that song. You know, guys that would have had nothing in common with Joe's politics. So, again, that's what music can do. It's that, as Craig said, it's that kind of bridge. It's that kind of authentic, centering element. And boy, you know, the thing was, Larry, you know, we're talking to people 40 years after they've been home. A lot of them had never talked about the experience, and we would ask them what their song was. We'd find out about the experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have Creedence Clearwater, Fortunate Son. Have we played Fortunate
Son? We opened
it. That's right. We opened it with it.
Seems like a long time ago.
Yeah, there we go.
Just to remind you.
How can I forget?
Oh, I named that tune in two notes.
We haven't done. Yeah, that's really it. You know right away what's coming. What's Going On by Marvin Gaye?
Wow.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, brother.
brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today.
Yeah. Oh, so who did Gay write this song about?
He wrote about his brother Frankie, who was a radio operator in Vietnam. You know, they grew up singers. They sang with Harvey and the Moonglows. Marvin gets to, you know, Motown and becomes their biggest solo artist. Frankie Gay gets he's in Vietnam. And, you know, we couldn't text you later. You're reading emails. You're getting phone. We couldn't do that in Vietnam. We wrote letters. That was the way we connected. So Frankie was writing letters to mom and dad, bearing his soul. It was therapy. I know when I wrote letters home, it was therapeutic, you know, what was bothering me. And he was talking about what was going wrong in Vietnam. Marvin asked the parents to pass the letters on to him and read them and was very concerned, met his brother when he got out. And really, if you listen to the entire album, what's going on, all the songs, one song leads into the other, it never ends. It's about a Vietnam vet coming back home. Is America going to be there for me? Am I going to make it home? Am I going to do drugs? Am I going to find God? It's a remarkable, remarkable album. And it's Marvin Gaye's way of helping his brother to come home and the rest of us to get back from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of our good friends, Art Flowers, African-American vet from Memphis, talked about when he came home from Vietnam, he was angry. And he spent a lot of time just getting stoned, getting drunk. And he said that he was just burning himself out. And then he was actually at a dorm room in the University of Tennessee with a woman he'd met. And he heard what's going on. And he said that once he heard that, he said, he's talking to me. And he said from that point on, it changed his life. And he said, I cannot just blow it away. He said from that point on, he was going to be a warrior for the humanity of his black brothers and all humanity, and that album saved him.
The song that you consider the Vietnam anthem is The Animals, We Gotta Get Out of This Place.
We gotta get out of this place.
And we're going to get out of this place in a couple minutes, Larry.
Yeah.
I can't thank you enough for having us and for folks listening. But again, it's the lyric of the song, not written about Vietnam, not intended for Vietnam. It was written by Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann as a follow-up to the Righteous Brothers. It was a Get Out of the Ghetto song. It ended up in sheet music over in England, where Alan Klein and Mickey Most gave it to the Animals. And they took it as their song. They're leaving Newcastle. They got to get out of this place, not like their daddy's in bed or dying, and they're going to become rock and roll stars. But it just, again, the lyric, the power of the song, as Craig said, if you were a cover band and you couldn't play that, we chase you off the stage. You had to play that song in front of the guys. And it's kept that connection all these years because, you know, those that didn't get back and those of us that did, we rally around that song.
And, man, this has been an interesting and powerful show today, guys. And I want to thank you both very much for being with us. And we'll probably be playing this song, replaying this show down the road here. I'm pretty sure of that. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, man. Doug Bradley and Craig Werner. And the book, I'd mention it again. The title is We Gotta Get Out of This Place. The soundtrack of the Vietnam War. Coming up, we're going to be talking about a new book. I heard there was a secret chord, Music as Medicine. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Now, my girl, you're so young and pretty. And one thing I know is true, yeah. You'll be dead before your time is due. Know it. Watch my dad.
secret chord. The David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? Well, it goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall and the major lift. The baffled king composing hallelujah.
Hallelujah. Oh, Jeff Buckley. His song, Singing Hallelujah, one of the songs that is talked about by the author of the book that we are going to be visiting about over the next hour. And the book's titled, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as Medicine. And lucky to have Daniel Levitin with us. Daniel's award-winning neuroscientist, musician, best-selling author. I think he has 4 bestsellers. His research is about music, the brain, health, productivity, and creativity. It's a fascinating read. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Let us know how music has maybe helped you heal. Which songs bring back maybe a specific memory for you? What kind of music do you play maybe to unwind after a long day or to get you going? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Daniel, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry. Nice to see you again.
I tell you what, I realize you know a lot of people in the music business.
I know Larry Myler.
A lot of people are featured. A lot of songs are featured in the book. And I'm just going to mention right up front, if you get a copy of his book or if you have it, just before the first chapter, you can scan to listen to the music that's featured in the book. And we'll be playing a few pieces as we go along today.
That's really fun.
we'll give it a shot. You're a neuroscientist and a musician.
That's what they tell me.
How'd you get interested in these fields, which on the face of it seems so different?
You know, it's a good question. I was always interested in science and always interested in music, and I was lucky to have school teachers who didn't force me to choose between the two. All the way through elementary school and high school and then college. I was a double major in college. And it was only when I went to graduate school that I realized I could combine the two. My advisor, Michael Posner, said, you're studying the brain and you could start studying the brain on music.
Yeah, why not? And so is that why you wrote this book? Why did you write this book about music as medicine?
You know, I realized as a working neuroscientist that the field had learned quite a bit in the last 10 years about how music can impact psychological and physical health, how it can be used, certain kinds of music in certain situations can be used to treat a variety of ailments and diseases, disorders. And most of that information had not trickled down to the public. It was stuck in dusty old journals in libraries. And I just wanted to share that knowledge with music lovers, but also with public policymakers, to get hospital administrators, even government officials, aware of the cost savings and the now proven benefits of music for a wide range of health applications.
And this book's been out now a year, is it? Somewhere around there.
Yeah, and today is the day when the paperback comes out.
Yeah.
And so people can get it for less money than the hardback, and it's easier to carry around.
And I have a copy of it in my hot little hand right now. And I really enjoyed reading it. And the feedback, what's the feedback been like?
Oh, well, it's been tremendously gratifying, Larry. I mean, from musician friends and even people I didn't know. Paul McCartney, for example, he used to have a band called Wings, and before that he had a band called The Beatles, if any of you have heard of him. he had read an advanced copy of the book through his publisher, and he liked it so much that he contributed a quote to the back of the book.
That's...
So that, you know, all that was very gratifying. And the quote was effectively that he'd wondered his whole life, why is it that music, which is just a bunch of frequencies, you know, like, and yeah. and he does it like this, boop, 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 boop. You know, it's just a bunch of frequencies, but when they're arranged in a particular way, they can bring us profound sadness or joy. They can alter our mood. How is it that that happens? And he says the book explains that.
We just spent an hour talking with Doug Bradley and Craig Werner about the songs of the Vietnam War.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And they wrote a, and I think they've talked with, may have visited with you about it. We got to get out of this place. The soundtrack of the Vietnam War was,
yeah,
was their book. And it's sort
of, that's the Eric Burdon song, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
And so music served as medicine then, but it served as medicine a long time back, further than that. Has it not?
Well, as far as we know, music's been around as long as humans have. The oldest artifacts we find at human and even Neanderthal burial sites are musical instruments, bone flutes and hollowed out logs that were used as drums with skin stretched across them. And going back even to the oldest written word we have, which is the Old Testament, there's that lovely passage that Leonard Cohen referenced in his song about how when King Saul, king of the Israelites, would fall into a depression, he would summon a young minstrel named David, who later became king and who later slew the giant Goliath. But David was called upon to play the lyre and bring Saul out of his depression so that he could govern the country.
Yeah. Well, how much is music, we talk about music therapy here a bit, how much is music therapy more than just listening to music that makes you feel good?
Well, so I would make a kind of a technical distinction here between music therapy and a music intervention. So music therapy is practiced by music therapists, which is a certification that people get. By studying it as a field. They are therapists who have learned to use music. And music therapy takes many forms. It's usually a dyadic relationship, a patient and a therapist, or it could be group therapy, but there's a therapist involved who may ask the patient or patients to engage in group drumming or singing or songwriting, or may prescribe, as it were, particular songs to achieve a therapeutic goal. That's different than, say, a music intervention, which is when I wanted to get through my exercise workout this morning. I'm not a music therapist, but I knew that if I listened to Van Halen, I would be able to exercise a little longer and harder than usually. And last night when I was having trouble going to sleep, I put on some Bach partitas and that relaxed me. Yeah. And that's all about, we know from surveys in my lab, most people in the Western world use music in this way as some sort of medicine.
How let's go to the basics here. How does sound interact with our bodies and make its way to our brain?
Well, that's really fascinating. So the only way you get sound into your brain is through the eardrums and bone conduction. And sound either comes out of loudspeakers or out of something that made the sound, like a tube that somebody blew through, a clarinet, or a string that somebody plucked on a guitar, or something, or your vocal cords is also a tube, like a clarinet, but it comes out of your mouth. The sound sets up a disturbance in the molecules in the atmosphere, and those molecules eventually make their way to your eardrum and cause it to wiggle in and out. And then from that wiggling in and out, a whole bunch of electrical activity happens in neurons that try to reconstruct what in the world was it that caused that particular wiggling in and out. Was it Van Halen or was it Enya? Was it Bach? And you know, it's really extraordinary that just from that, the brain can reverse engineer what happened, and you can pick out an oboe from a cello or you can recognize Johnny Cash's voice in an instant, and it's all happening in the brain at that point.
And where does it happen in the brain? It happens in, there's not a specific spot, is there?
It's a difficult question.
Yeah,
it'd be like asking, where is gravity in your studio? Well, it's distributed.
Yeah,
I mean,
all over.
It's sort of everywhere, but if you were to drop that microphone, it would drop in a particular place. So music in the brain is distributed. There are specialized circuits for things like detecting pitch or rhythm. There are specialized circuits that keep track of lyrics or predict what's going to come next in the song. In fact, music activates every part of the brain that we've so far mapped. And I'm not even talking about things like dancing to music, which is kind of automatic.
I think you mentioned even sleep.
Yes. Yeah.
Every part of our brain. Georgia and Madison has something. Let's go there. Hi, Georgia.
Hi. My partner had a major right brain stroke in 2014 in his right median artery, and he's paralyzed on the left and walks with great difficulty and with a quad cane with somebody helping him along. But he discovered recently that he walks better with music, and particularly Wilson Pickett and Johnny Cash. And Johnny Cash has got a song called Get Rhythm, and Mustang Sally works pretty well. I wondered if your guest had an insight into why that works.
Yeah.
So this is well known among the neuroscience community. I devote a whole chapter to it, Music for Movement. And I talk about the case of people with Parkinson's, but it applies more generally. Often people with Parkinson's disease lose the ability to walk. And the reason is that the disease attacks the very cells, the brain cells, the neurons, that coordinate voluntary movements, like putting one foot in front of the other. And one of the consequences is that timing circuit that, you know, it's not just putting one foot in front of the other, but at a steady pace to walk smoothly and continuously. But if we play music that has the tempo of your normal walking speed, within about 5 seconds, the brain synchronizes to that beat, the intact parts of the brain, and then they take over for the damaged part of the brain and allow somebody to walk smoothly and continuously, even after the music stops playing.
That's amazing. Georgia, thank you very much for calling. And maybe Kate and Eau Claire has something that may relate. Let's go there. Hi, Kate.
Hi. Oh, thank you. I'm so glad. I didn't think I'd get on. My mother had dementia for a long time, and I would take her generation of music to listen to. We were sitting in the dining room one time. People who were like in the awakening, catatonic, being fed. The women, when this Gershwin tune started up with, don't be a naughty baby, come to papa, do. Lifted their spoons in the air, sang along, and went back to being catatonic. It was phenomenal. And I had just one other short comment about tunes like Paco Bell's Canon that has rising and descending notes. Someone reflected that might have something to do with the heartbeat in utero, if you could comment on that, that so many people are attracted to that type of passage in music. Thank you. I'll hang up.
Oh, thank you very much for calling, Kate. Well, a couple of things there.
Well, so Paco Bell's Canon is much loved.
It is indeed.
Often played at the tempo of about a heartbeat. One of the first things the infant hears, of course, is the developing infant in the womb, is the mother's heartbeat. We now know that the auditory system of the developing infant is fully functional by 20 weeks. And so they're hearing all sorts of stuff from the outside world and the heartbeat. And I don't know why that ascending pattern, bum, 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 bum. It's just, I don't know why that's so compelling, but it is. Probably because it outlines the chords that it's playing, and it allows the listener to be an active participant in recreating the arpeggio into a tonal center. The Alzheimer's case is very interesting, and I devote a chapter in my book, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, to that. My colleague Oliver Sacks worked on a film called Alive Inside, and there's a wonderful example there, many of you will have seen it, of a catatonic patient who's been on the ward in Brooklyn for a couple of months and hasn't said a word. And then Oliver brings in an iPod, because iPods were new back then, and plays him some Cab Calloway songs from his youth. And he perks up and he sings along, and he then becomes loquacious and starts talking for the first time. I think the way I describe it in the book is this. The difficulty with profound memory loss, Alzheimer's, dementia, is that the stricken individuals at some point no longer recognize their loved ones. They don't know where they are. And they might not even recognize themselves in a mirror. And in the face of such profound disorientation, they often turn inward because the outside world makes no sense. And then the music brings them back because those memories are intact. Memories from your teenage years are the last to go.
Hmm. Daniel Levitin, our guest today, as we talk with him about his book, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as Medicine. And you can join in with your own experiences or questions. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Imagine. One of the songs that is discussed in Daniel Levitin's book, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as Medicine. And, you know, music is more than just listening, as I listened to that song. And you found that listening to music stimulates a visual imagery in the brain, does it not?
It does. Not for everybody and not in all circumstances. But one thing is that typically when we have people in a brain scanner and they're listening to music, we see activity in the visual centers of the brain. It's in the back of the head, visual cortex, occipital lobe, for those of you keeping track. And we ask them what's going on. I say, well, I'm picturing James Brown dancing and singing at the same time. Or a particular song evoked images of a beach or a landscape, or another song evoked images of my grandfather because he loved that song. And so music, you know, we talked before the break about how music activates every part of the brain. It's a really good retrieval cue for memories. It's like Proust had written about the Madeleine cookie, bringing back a flood of memories, and smells do that. Music brings these things back.
Bill in Madison has something for us that may relate to this. Bill, hi.
Hi. Very much so. I had in 1999 a traumatic brain injury. It was a subdural, a full brain bleed, and I was in ICU. They put me into a light coma. When I came out, I mean, it's been a struggle, but what all of a sudden when I was home and I'm watching TV and the theme of Barney Miller came on, which I watched as a kid, it was like all these lights went off. It was just amazing, the circuitry in my brain. And my therapist, he said, well, yeah, your computer is starting to reboot. And ever since then, I mean, you know, I put on Simon and Garfunkel, all this stuff. I was a drummer, and all of a sudden I find myself moving to the beat. Absolutely incredible. And then I went out dancing again. Oh, my God. And I tell people, I said, if you ever go into a room and somebody's in a coma, though, I think the best thing you can do, bring in music they love. And I think you mentioned that earlier, but it was just, and still is, amazing.
Bill, thank you for calling. Comment, Daniel?
Well, we now appreciate that pretty much every experience you've ever had that was meaningful to you is in your brain somewhere. The problem is finding it. It's your brain is not that well organized. It's like a filing cabinet drawer that's got a bunch of files that are labeled, but then a whole bunch more that are unlabeled, or they have the wrong labels on them. And then there's just a whole bunch of papers thrown in there that nobody ever bothered to file. And so every once in a while, if you get the right cue, is what we call it in my business, the right probe, you find that file. And in general, the most resilient memories are those that are the oldest. Computer scientists talk about first in, last out. And that's the principle. The earlier memories stay intact. And as we age, we sometimes regress to our younger age because those are the only memories we have.
Speaking of memories, you tell a good story about Ella Fitzgerald in the book Singing Mac the Knife. Tell that story. You have so many, by the way, you have so many wonderful stories to illustrate what you're talking about with things that have happened to people and how they have progressed or maybe not progressed, but mostly progressed when they use music. But talk about Ella Fitzgerald and Mac the Knife.
Yeah, well, so, you know, I like reading popular books about science and world affairs, and I like reading, about contemporary political books. But to me, a good story can make a point better than just the dry facts. Now, yeah. The dry facts are important, but they're dry. A good story has a kind of relatability that the cold facts don't. And so you're asking how I came to write the book earlier. I read about 4,000 journal articles, and they're all cited in the back of the book there in small type, but they're there. And so this is all based on science. But if I could find a story that would illustrate a principle, I felt that it would get the point across better if I got the right story. And Ella is an example of that. She did a concert in Berlin in 1959 or 60, I forget now, and live show, and she forgot the words to Mac the Knife. And because she was a consummate performer, and was always thinking about the audience experience rather than her own experience, you know, how can I entertain? How can I keep the show going? The show must go on, right?
Yeah.
So realizing that she forgets the lyrics, she doesn't say, oh, let's stop and start over again. Or does somebody have the lyrics? She just keeps going, and she improvises lyrics on the spot. And some of the lyrics are, I'm making a wreck of Mac the Knife, or this part I don't remember. But she manages to generate, I mean, this is very early freestyle, very early. I mean, it's not rapping because she's keeping the melody, but it's, you know, a very early example of freestyling poetry where she maintains the rhyme scheme of the original song and maintains the rhythm and all of the accents and the melody. She just doesn't know the words. But it's a marvelous example of the capacity of the human mind to remember some things and not others. So she forgot the words, but she remembered the sentiment. She remembered there was something about a tugboat down by a river. You know, I mean, she remembered certain things and not others. And I just, you know, I find that fascinating.
I do as well. Music is a gateway to accessing memories. You know, how can music help us pull out memories that are so difficult to locate?
Well, it doesn't work with all music. It works with music that's associated with a particular experience you had. So maybe there was that summer, Larry, when you were 13 years old and there was a particular song that you liked and you and your friends listened to it all the time. Or maybe you were carpooling to a softball game and that was always on the radio. Because back in those days, a top 40 station meant they only played 40 records.
Yeah.
They played them over and over and over again. So if you haven't heard the song regularly since then, it's uniquely associated with a time and a place and all the friends you were with and the things you were doing. And that's how music can evoke the memory. It wouldn't work so well with a song like Happy Birthday or the National Anthem, which we hear in so many different contexts. It works best when a song is associated with a particular context. It's why if you break up with somebody, a romantic partner, and then years later you hear that song that was our special song, it can reduce you to a puddle of tears.
Yeah, it can. It can indeed. Jay and Two Rivers, what's on your mind?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. When I was young, and you can imagine how old I am now, the three most important things in high school were having a girlfriend, a working car, and a stereo. Back then, though, my stereo was only mono, and it used vacuum tubes. And up until, maybe the last 5-10 years, it was important to have a good car stereo. But now driving is stimulating enough that I don't really need the music. And though I have a good stereo that still uses vacuum tubes, I don't listen to it as much. And I'm wondering if it's just me or if it's common as one ages to access music less often.
Is it less important for us as we age, or for some at least?
I think we go through phases of life where some things are more important and some things are less, and I don't know that it's necessarily a function of aging. We have other things to occupy our time when we get older. We might have grandchildren or hobbies or things. We feel that we have less time, and if we don't really love listening to music, we're not going to spend the time doing it. It also can be hard to find music that's, it's easy to get tired of things you've been listening to for 50 years, and it can be hard to find new music that you like. The streaming stations, Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, Pandora, are not quite there yet, but they're getting pretty good at making recommendations. So I hop in the car and I throw Spotify on, particularly if I'm in traffic and I'm bored. And it's got a playlist for me every day, and it's based on what I've listened to. And a good number of those songs are things I've never heard before. Some of them I don't like, but some I just discovered Claro this way. A new singer, she's nominated for a Grammy, I believe, C-L-A-I-R-O. I just love her. Young singer. I discovered Jacob Collier that way. And, I think the act of discovery is something that is neuroprotective and healthful. So whether you're discovering new books or new friends or new music, it's something that can help stave off the effects of aging, which is the topic of my previous book just before this one, Successful Aging.
Why is it so? Music seems much easier to remember. I mean, just an hour ago, we were playing all these songs from the 60s and the 70s, and I think I could come pretty close to the words on every one of the ones that we played.
So from a cognitive science standpoint, music is what we would call a highly structured stimulus. Think of the game tic-tac-toe versus chess. Tic-tac-toe has a lot of constraints, which is why kids love to play it and adults less so. We grow out of it. Chess has so many fewer constraints that it's a game you can play at a very high level for the rest of your life. Music is more like chess. More like tic-tac-toe than chess. It can be as stimulating as chess, but it has constraints, meaning that the mutually reinforcing cues of rhythm and accent structure and meter and tempo, plus the semantics of the song. If it's a song about cars, you know there's going to be driving and maybe somebody having trouble getting off a seatbelt or whatever it is. Referring to a Chuck Berry song, of course. The idea is that even if you don't remember every single word, it's probably going to be easy to recreate the song.
Oh, gee, thanks. Rob, a certified NICURN, loves the topic of conversation we're having here. He just wanted to clarify for listeners the auditory structures and the ability to hear some low frequencies is intact at about 20 weeks gestation. However, the auditory system is not fully developed till 28 weeks gestation, when it gains the ability to hear a wider range of frequencies and the connections between the thalamus and auditory cortex have become more mature. So he's referring back to something you were talking about earlier. A listener emailed us, does music help heal damage to or deterioration of the cerebellum?
We don't know how to cure damage to any brain structure, but the brain is massively redundant. It has a lot of supplementary pathways. And so cerebellar damage, which can cause difficulty with emotion perception and with movements, either voluntary or involuntary movements, swallowing is an involuntary movement, for example, walking is voluntary. You can't repair damage to the cerebellum, but you can use music to restore some functionality for motivation or for coordinating movement, for synchronizing movements. And music can also restore some sense of emotion when people become flat emotionally, effectively what we call anhedonic from cerebellar damage, because music can be so powerfully emotional. And it can activate supplementary motion circuits in the frontal lobes.
Anne in Marshfield, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Anne.
Hello, fellows. It's nice to talk to you.
Thanks for joining in.
I wanted to ask the researcher, did you research Ronald Reagan? I understand toward the end of his presidency, he would check out and something would trip him and he would check back in. And it was a precursor of his eventual Alzheimer's, of course. But I wondered if you checked on his life at all.
Well, I did for my previous book, For Successful Aging, because I had known his Secretary of State and Secretary of the Treasury, George Shultz, since the 1980s. And Shultz was very close with Reagan and visited him even after he left the presidency. And Shultz was aware of some lapses in President Reagan's attention and memory. You may recall there was a widely reported incident where President Reagan thought that he'd been a pilot in the war. And in fact, that was, he was remembering a role that he had played in a film and it didn't actually happen to him. Mistake that many actors might make and many might not. But back in those days, in the 80s, people weren't as aware of the course of Alzheimer's or how to diagnose it and assess it. So from what I understand from Secretary Shultz, President Reagan was really in command up to the end of his presidency. But yeah, he would go in and out. But I got to tell you, when I was 20 years old, I would go in and out. And as a professor who teaches 20-year-olds, I can tell you, they're not always engaged in all there either. So it's not just aging.
No, you're absolutely right about that. Oh, my goodness. And that's why all my years of teaching, I would tell stories that would seem to re-engage folks along the way. And you had to do that about every 10 minutes.
Yeah.
About every 10 minutes.
Professor tricks.
To re-engage. Well, dementia, you say dementia, excuse me, in your book, affects multiple systems of the brain's machinery, intricate machinery. And music stimulates the damaged brain's language network.
Yeah, so perhaps a story is the best way to illustrate this. And that's Gabby Giffords, the congresswoman who was shot in the language areas of the brain and could not speak. But she underwent a course of therapy, music therapy, where she learned to sing what she needed to say. Things like, I need to go to the bathroom, or please get a glass of water. You know, normal daily life necessities. And through the act of singing, which she could do, she was able to scaffold and on the language centers and eventually learn to speak without singing. So again, it gets back to this idea we were talking about, Larry, where there's a multiple redundancy in the brain, multiple systems accomplish similar or identical things. And it's the matter of finding the right circuit that you can use to supplement a damaged circuit. I kind of think of it like this. If you've got a broken outlet in your living room and you still need a lamp, you just get an extension cord and you plug it into another outlet. The electricity is still there. It's just not where you thought it was.
You have a great story. And you were friends with Joni Mitchell.
Yeah.
And I was hoping you'd relate that story because it relates to what we're just talking about here.
So I'd known Joni since 1996, and as was widely reported in March of 2015, she suffered a burst aneurysm and a brain bleed, and she was put into the emergency room where she stayed for 3 months. And the damage caused by the aneurysm, which is effectively a hemorrhagic stroke, was deemed to be incurable. She was sent home without any follow-up care. And I went and visited her within a few days of her being out of the hospital when she was first able to see visitors. And it seemed as though she was responding to music coming from the other room that the nurses were listening to. Now, she couldn't walk. She couldn't talk. She couldn't even respond by shaking her head at that point. But she kind of perked up when she heard music. So we started playing her music that we knew she loved. And within a few weeks, she regained a kind of consciousness, like we were talking about earlier, half an hour ago with the Alzheimer's patients. She regained a sort of connection to what was going on in the world, and she started bobbing her head along with the music. And that was all I needed to know to call in a neurologist and a physical therapist, a speech therapist, cognitive therapist, to get her walking and talking and singing again.
It was an amazing, amazing story to me, and good on you.
I'm glad I was there at the right time.
Oh, man. Our guest today, Daniel Levitin, his latest book, you've got to take a look at it. It's titled, I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, Music as Medicine. And you can join in, too, and I hope you do. What's your experience with music? Perhaps as medicine. I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Well, that is our guest today is not only a good writer, but he's a good singer and songwriter. And then Levitin's song, Headed for the Fall, we were listening to. And you wrote this and played it. We were just talking about Joni Mitchell. If I'm not mistaken, you wrote this and played this for Joni.
Yeah, we were getting together once a month or so between about 2002 and 2015. And we'd play each other whatever songs we were working on. And she took an interest in my songwriting. And as I was writing it, she helped me to uncover some metaphors for the song that I hadn't realized were there, which is lovely. I mean, I was writing it about being depressed and falling into depression. But she says, you know, heading for the fall, it could also mean Adam and Eve, the fall from grace. It could mean a waterfall. And, you know, heading for the falls, you know, in a boat, the boat's about to go off the deep end. And so just the way she thinks about songwriting and metaphor and allegory helped me not just with that song, but with all my songs since. It was a tremendously enriching experience. And I like to think that I was able to help her some with her songs, which I know that she invited me to help her put together four of her records around that time. And that was a really rewarding experience.
And writing, you do talk in the book about how one of the therapies involves producing music and the what happens in the brain. Well, not only when you're playing an instrument, but when you're writing a song. Something goes on in the brain.
There's this program called Songwriting with Soldiers, among others, where soldiers back from armed conflict with PTSD are paired with professional songwriters, and they take the trauma and they write about it, and that gets it outside their body, and it becomes something more objective, and it stops eating away at them. It's not corroding the vessel that contains them because it's now out in the world. And you don't have to be a professional songwriter to work with a professional songwriter. You express your feelings, they help you shape them. I go once a year to a camp for musicians and aspiring musicians in outside of Nashville, run by Victor Wooten, a great bass player, who's on tour right now with Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. I happened to see them yesterday at the Ford Theater in L.A. And Victor and I did the songwriting camp, and there was this girl who was really very depressed named Rachel, and she'd never written a song before. And we, with a group of musicians that were there, drummer, bass player, keyboard player, guitarist, just asked her to talk about her feelings. And every once in a while, Victor or I would latch onto a phrase and we'd say, well, that's something that you could say again in a more musical way. And then the band starts accompanying her. And within about 20 minutes, she had an amazing song that captured what she was feeling. And she felt better. And that effect lingered for months.
Suzanne in Madison has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just turned 69 and been very much a hiker and up and down steep hills and such. But I noticed the last couple of years my legs getting quite sluggish and off pace. And I just naturally started counting 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, and my legs just respond to that and move at the pace that I'm counting. And I can increase the speed of the counting, and my legs just naturally respond, and they stay moving. So, somewhat like the beat of a heart or the beat of music. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling. Comments, Daniel?
Self-medication, it works.
It does indeed. Chris in Richland Center, what's on your mind?
I was just going to tell you that I had worked in a nursing home for many years, and we had a phenomenon among residents there called sundowning, and they would get very upset, anxious, irate, and we had one particular woman who would she'd beat the tar out of us every day, and eventually I figured out that when she was calm and relaxed, she was humming to herself and she was singing to herself, and they were lullaby. So I started putting a lullaby on a tape recorder in her room, and I would start playing that a few minutes before we went in to get her up. And as we got her up, I'd say, oh, do you hear the music? And she'd start singing along with it. And we wouldn't get beat up anymore.
Oh.
And it was really nice. But on another tack there, I also know that when I'm cleaning house, the best house cleaning music in the world for me. Rolling Stones, Hot Rocks, you just get a wiggle on and you got it done.
And there's one chapter you talk about music in the home, and which gets into the some of that. Talk about that a bit.
Well, I did a study with Apple and Sonos, the speaker company, where we tried to understand how people use music in the home, and we put wireless Sonos speakers in some people's homes for a week, and then we had them not listen to music for a week, and it was really fascinating. It was a well-controlled study. There was a range of ages and ethnicities and socioeconomic background, countries, even different countries, people who had music playing in the home tended to spend more time together and in closer proximity to one another. We had these things Apple makes called an eye beacon, where it could tell how close you are to someone else if they're wearing an iWatch. And I'm not advertising for Apple. They're just the ones who funded the study. Because they were interested in the science behind it. People sat closer together. They spent more time together. If there were kids in the house, the kids spent more time helping to prepare a meal and wash up after. And the couples reported having 30% more sexual activity during a week in which music was playing out loud. Maybe they were wiggling to the Rolling Stones. I don't know.
Well, it lets me think that maybe music isn't a bad thing to have in the house. If you've got the house full, you know, you come home and the spouse and maybe a couple of kids are there, music wouldn't be a bad thing to have going.
Well, and the other thing about the Sonos speakers that was unique at the time, and I don't know if other wireless speakers do this because I only know the Sonos, but you can control them in such a way that you can have the same song playing in multiple rooms of the house, or different members of the family can have their own music playing on the Sonos that's in their bedroom or their space. And where you can broadcast your music to other rooms of the house. So like you might be in your office, Larry, and I might be working at your house at the opposite end of the house or the apartment, you know, in another office. And we're just doing our thing. And then a song comes on that I want you to hear. I just broadcast it to your room.
Oh man! Here we are getting close to the end of the hour. We haven't even begun to scratch the surface. Why should society place value in music? What riches does it offer our lives?
Well, I think for most people, music is an experience that they feel they describe as an essential part of being human. It's an aesthetic experience. It brings great joy and introspective possibilities, great personal growth. But in a more practical way, Larry, I think we're facing a healthcare system with spiraling costs, an aging population, and in many cases, treatments that don't work. And certainly not cost effectively. My favorite example of this is that if you go into surgery, prior to knocking you out, they're going to give you a muscle relaxant, emotional relaxant, maybe Valium. And the way the pharmaceutical hospital complex works is that Valium that you might pay $3 for at the corner drugstore is going to cost $750 in the hospital on average. And we've now seen studies that show that listening to relaxing music prior to surgery is just as effective, at least as effective as the Valium. And it's much cheaper, and there's no addictive consequence. And so.
And no $700 bill.
Exactly right.
Daniel, this is a lovely book. Thank you so much for writing it and for being with us today. I really appreciate it, and I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'd like to give a shout out to my friend in Madison, Ben Sidran, the great jazz musician.
He's a great, great guy. Daniel Levitin, I heard there was a secret chord, music as medicine. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thank you for listening.
Well, it goes like this, the four.